What you gonna wear when you die? When you float up to the sky? You gonna wear trousers or a skirt when they put you in the dirt? My mama said, don't be scared, they'll be good to you up there. So I don't worry anymore, brush my teeth and do my chores. And Lord, if I am blessed, gonna wear a pink lacy dress and a long white satin coat.
Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. That song you just heard is called Psychic Repair, and it was recorded by the artist Farah Al-Qasimi. You'll be hearing more of her music throughout the show. What you're hearing right now is a recording of my neighborhood in rural Northern California. I'm talking to you from the era of coronavirus lockdown. And every night during the pandemic, at precisely 8 p.m., around here, people start to howl. In the last episode, Samson Young played a recording of people in Hong Kong yelling protest chants out their windows at 10 p.m. every night as their way of staying connected during a crisis. And here it is happening again. Out here, the dogs and birds like to join in. Someone, maybe a child, has also been leaving little painted rocks around the neighborhood, on mailboxes and front doorsteps, as their way of staying connected, turning to art when they have nothing else to do. This is a show about the subject, object, and verb, which is my way of saying the artist, art, and life. Right now, at least as I'm recording this, most of our lives have been regulated. We're all basically homebodies at the moment. This is a radical change for some people, but for others who prefer the reclusive lifestyle, the change may be barely noticeable. In this episode, I speak to the painter Josh Smith, who is one of these people well suited to this moment. Though I didn't actually know that until we recorded this interview. Even during times of healthy commingling populations, he still prefers to stay at home, sometimes not leaving his building for up to 6 months at a time. I also talk with Patrick Langley, one of the writers for Art Review, about art made via telephone, which is one of the few modes of communication our personal expression can be filtered through these days. And finally, we'll be getting a communication-based performance by the artist Angharad Williams. I'm not going to say much more about that one, so you can have fresh, unprimed ears when you listen. But first, Farah Al-Qasimi. What you're hearing now is another one of her tracks. It's called Music for Homes, and it was commissioned by Art Dubai's Global Art Forum for a broadcast during the pandemic. Al-Qasimi is primarily known as a photographer and a filmmaker. She takes photographs that are textural and patterned and eye-poppingly vibrant. They almost have the appearance of collage, and the elements within the photos can look hyper-real. It's flowers and malls and beauty pageants and salons. Little unexpected moments of visual indulgence at the center of a busy world. Right now, her images are up all over New York on bus stops as a part of her project with Public Art Fund called Back and Forth Disco. But as you're hearing, she's also a musician. She was trained as a classical pianist, and she writes the music for most of her films, like her recent horror comedy called Mother of Fire, which is about djinn, who are intelligent spirits that can possess humans. This film music is usually pretty synthesizer-based, but she's also recorded with her punk band called Soft Signals. For our interview, I initially called her on one of these newfangled internet communication programs, but that quickly failed on us, so we switched over to the phone with its old-timey quality of sound.
My dream was to be a film score composer, which is, you know, obviously I'm a huge fan of Wendy Carlos. I'm a huge fan of John Carpenter for that reason too. And for a lot of the women who, who made a lot of really fabulous experimental music in the 70s and 80s, like Laurie Spiegel and Laurie Anderson, Paulina Oliveros. And so I kind of came to music with that, with the desire to learn more about these composers. And yet I had the red tape of taking about a million theory classes. And I took one, I took the most basic one, and I got a C. And I was at Yale on scholarship, and I had to maintain a certain GPA. And I was doing well, except for that. So I was like, all right, I can't do this. But I learned a lot. I mean, I took all of the music classes that I really wanted to take. I just kind of stopped doing it more formally. I was trained classically on piano for years, and I was really good at one point, and now I'm not. But I still try and play every day. I have a keyboard in my studio, and I've also been playing in punk bands since I was a teenager. It sort of stopped when I went to grad school, which is a real bummer. And I was actually going to play. My good friend Joe Heffernan is a really incredible percussionist, and we were going to play a show together at the gallery on the orange carpet. But then, you know, obviously we've had to push everything back or cancel it. So I've been trying to write a really crappy album, and I've been doing all of the audio in my bathroom. I don't really want to be, you know, singing audio tracks in my apartment to myself and bothering my neighbors. So I'm trying to be inventive about how I make music, but I still feel like, I don't know, it's such an important part of my life. I do sometimes wonder if I had just been a little bit better at math, what could have happened? But the album that I'm writing at home now is just all me. And so I think it's really lacking. I know this, you know, I don't have any delusions about what it's like to be a multi-instrumentalist recording on single tracks by yourself. It lacks a lot of the energy that happens when you are playing with somebody at the same time. What am I going to do? You know, this is like, I can't be around other people. And also I don't have the money to hire like a session musician or anything. So I'm just gonna have to be like comfortable with being an awkward, mediocre band camp musician who begs their friends to listen to their stuff.
Seven years ago, I sent an email to the painter Josh Smith, asking about an interview. 4 years later, I received a one-line response. It then took another 3 years before we were able to find an afternoon in the winter of 2019 to meet. Smith is pretty resistant to socializing, and he prefers to spend long stretches of time in his Brooklyn home, a vast, largely windowless warehouse he's transformed into a live-work complex. Throughout the building's two stories, he's set up several spaces for his art, a workshop for building, a ceramic studio with a kiln, a casual studio mostly used for storage, and a primary large painting studio with a ping pong table he said that he uses for exercise. For our talk, we sat in his library, which is walled with gray metal shelves and many, many books, mostly about art, but also history and novels and poetry. This interview was recorded about 2 months before the pandemic broke out.
Well, I spend long periods of time alone, like maybe months sometimes, like months, like maybe 6 months. Sometimes I won't leave, you know, my studio.
You won't leave this building?
Mm-mm. And that would be like a worst case scenario, and it's not healthy. So yeah, you kind of get delusional a little bit. Yeah, you kind of lose touch with reality a little bit. I love that. I think that's a luxury. It sucks, you know, when you do go back out into the world, you realize how fucked up you are. I mean, how messed up you are, because you don't know how to talk to people, really.
Do you find that good work comes out of these periods of hiding out?
I have to do it to get my work done. Ideally, I'd be more of a person who like works a few hours a day and then goes out for drinks with friends. But I guess I'm trying to work my way there. I have a problem with that. I have a social problem. I don't socialize very much. And I know really great people, and I know this city's teeming with wonderful people. I don't know how to access them necessarily. I have to work a lot to make sure that my work is really good. Like I don't clock out. I don't. There's no clocking out. Like, so
you're just working off and on from...
Well, I call work, you know, being locked in. I'm not like painting like all the time. It's just locked in. Like, yeah, just waiting for work and thinking and digging around, and I can't tell you anything exciting about it except that, you know, it's a lifestyle.
Do you get a routine going during these periods?
No. My life is built so I can do that. Like, I don't have any I don't have any responsibilities to, I don't have a family or anything. And the people, who know me know that that's what makes me happy, and they leave me alone. And I mean, I like to stay up all night when I'm working, because you're the only person in the world at night. I mean, there's no car, you don't hear the cars outside, or, I mean, I don't know. I try to be a good artist, you know, and to be a good artist, I think you have to feel like you're kind of falling a lot. Like, you're kind of slipping and falling, and it's uncomfortable. You're always looking for a handhold or a foothold, or it's uncomfortable. I don't love it. I appreciate what I make and what I do. It is uncomfortable, and it's kind of sick. It's kind of a sick lifestyle.
But you seem like you're pretty happy during these phases.
You haven't seen me during these phases. Like, you're seeing me now. Like,
but the way you speak about it, it sounds like it's
not
unpleasant.
Well, in hindsight, yeah, there's nothing like going into your studio with like two bags of Fritos and six Red Bulls, and, you know, you just work all night and just you're by yourself, and you know you have to get stuff done. I mean, there's a stinking show, you know, that comes. Like, I've always made art for something. I've never just made art. Everyone asks someone, how long have you been an artist? I'm like, well, I've always been an artist. Yeah, we all have, but like, you know, it's always an assignment, you know, like starting in kindergarten or whatever, like draw your house or draw your family. Bang, there it is, you know, and then it grows like that. In school, it's like you're doing something for a critique or something like that, or a printmaking studio, you know, print, that's, you're on the clock in there. I'm a creative person, but it's always applied. So I want my job to be fun, you know, as fun as possible, given what's going on. I see how other people work and stuff, and it's different than the way I work. And I envy them a little bit, but I know what I need to do to do what I have to do. I envy people who don't seem so stressed out like I can get. Yeah. I mean, we've never met. And like, you emailed me years ago and it took me like 3 or 4 years to write back. But I mean, that's just because I'm not a jerk. I just get, I'm in a spider web, you know? I'm not a spider. I'm just like in a spider web, just trying to like avoid being eaten, you know, by myself, like just eaten up. Like I'm always wondering how people do it, how great artists do it. It's confusing to me.
Is that maybe what all these books are about in some ways, learning about other artists and how they get through?
Yeah. I mean, people who have lived a whole life and done this or that. And I mean, I respect all aspects of it. I respect people who have to pull stuff out of nothing. And there's also a lot of tricks and stuff that people do, and I don't want to do those tricks.
Like, what's a trick?
Just using weird materials and, you know, settling into something and making a run out of it. You could go your whole career, you know, doing one thing. I'm not going to name names because some of those people are still around, but it drives me insane that you're just repeating yourself over and over. In that type of insecurity, I mean, it is insecurity. It bothers me. I think it's conservative. It's conservative.
When you are in these periods where you're not leaving, or maybe just in general, what is it about the outside world that feels unattractive to you?
It's not unattractive. I just don't feel like I have the time to engage in it. I deprive myself of it. It's like fasting or something. I'm deprived. I mean, that's thought provoking. And I'm speaking mostly specifically about the last show I did in New York, which was in May or April. That just was a daunting thing. There was a lot of, I just wanted it to be good. I feel like all shows I do, and I mean this, I mean everything at first, but I feel like it could be my last show, you know. There's times when you're a little more easygoing about it, but in New York, I feel like there's so many artists and so many galleries, and also my closest peers are here, and I don't want to think that I didn't do the best that I could and, you know, test everything out as best as I want to feel like I am the work, you know, that I'm in it. Like, it's like it's saturated in me. I mean,
do you just exhaust yourself? Is that why you feel like it's maybe your last show?
I feel like that all the opportunities are gifts. Yeah. I mean, also I try to make work that is really bad, you know, like bad enough that it could go either way, you know, like no, everyone could hate it or a lot of people could love it. Those are both pretty good solutions. Kind of a weird show to have is one where you don't really hear much about it, you know.
That's sort of the worst outcome, right?
Then you can dig into your ego and say that you did that one for yourself, you know, like that's your show. I've done one like that. And I think, I mean, maybe this is just me doing that, like puffing myself up, but I loved that show, which was just, there were just white paintings with a few lines on them. Yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate because I can roll through things. Like a lot of artists don't have the agility. I mean, they have it, but I've built I hope I can do whatever I want. You know, I don't think I've closed any doors for myself as an artist. Like it would be hard for some people to change, and I can change. Like I can change. Artists I gravitate towards as friends and peers are ones that can do that too. They're not locked in to like being like a formal abstract painter or a person who does just text-based work. Or I like people who can, you know, see the whole field and see where they have to move to get somewhere. Talking about it today is good because, you know, I forget, but everything I know and everything I learn, I can put into the art. Like, you'll never notice it, you know, but it helps just to know that I put it in there. And it does add to the richness. It does. It sure does. Like, also, when I'm, like, holed up working, I bring a lot of stuff in. You know, just because I'm not going out, like I'll bring a lot of stuff in, like to
what kind of
like
stuff?
Objects, and you see stuff everywhere, like baskets and stuff from Africa. I don't work with a lot of books in the studio. Some people I go into their studio, it's all like art books and stuff. I don't want any of that in my studio. Like I want whatever I look at here. By the time I get upstairs, you know, it's already started to degrade. Like, I think art's, I mean, even several times today, twice, in fact, today I've thought, what the hell am I doing here? But now I'm thinking about how lucky I am to be able to do this, so.
What the hell are you doing here in New York?
Yeah, yeah. Because I didn't come from here. I came, you know, from kind of a peaceful place, like
Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. I think I like to show off, and I think I want a receptive audience, and I don't like, you know, mediocrity. So you can see, I can spot trends really easily, and I don't like trends. You know, I relish like bulldozing through trends.
Like, you seem like you're responding a lot to the world as it's occurring.
Yeah, I don't want people getting in other people's footsteps too much. Like, I don't think that's why you should come here. I think you should come here to make your own footsteps. And when I see, you know, Dave Hickey said something like this once in a book where he's like, if you see a bunch of people over there, then it's logical to go to the other side and do something over there, you know. He said it, you know, in his way, but I always think like that. And I protect myself a lot. Like I know I should be more social. I do. But where do you start? I guess I'm starting by having you over here.
This is the beginning.
Yeah, the beginning.
After the interview, Smith brought me downstairs to the basement where he grows a pretty impressive variety of leafy green vegetables using bright grow lights. He spent about 10 minutes carefully snipping until he stuffed a whole bag filled with lettuces and chards, which he gave me as a parting gift. Now, we'll hear from Patrick Langley on telephone art. Langley writes a series of short monthly pieces for Art Review, mostly on the relationship between sound and visual art, especially the ways that sound can be messy, how it can spill out of galleries, how it isn't nice and tidy like a framed painting. It's hard to contain. His most recent piece is on telephones and the way artists have used telephones as their medium. He writes about John Giorno's famous dial-a-poem project, which was launched in 1968. Anyone could call a hotline and hear a recording by many great poets like Bernadette Mayer, William Burroughs, Anne Waldman, Allen Ginsberg. Here's a 9-second dial-up poem recording by Aram Saroyan.
Not a cricket ticks a clock.
In the piece, Patrick also writes about a more recent work called Breezer by the artist Angharad Williams, which he saw in 2013 and described for me in our conversation.
As I was trying to think about examples of the telephones they appeared in contemporary art, the one that really, really stuck with me and is actually probably one of the more memorable pieces of performance art I've ever seen, actually, is from 2013. And it was at a show in Cafe Gallery, which is in South London, and it's in a park. And there were various performances, and the one that really stuck out was by this artist, Angharad Williams, a young artist. And it began with her asking the audience, we're quite a small audience, maybe 15 people, if she could have someone's phone number, which made people sort of really uncomfortable, actually. And they were sort of squirming in their seats, and there was a lot of side eyes and people not kind of wanting to put themselves forward. But eventually someone did. And then Angharad took this person's number. And I remember not knowing exactly why she'd asked this, or if the performance had begun yet, or what was happening. And then to add to my confusion, she just left the gallery and she just walked out the door. And so we were waiting for a good 5 minutes or so, looking at each other. No one was speaking. And it created, a kind of quite a heightened awareness of the other members of the audience. And she had given one instruction before she left, which is that she was going to call and that the person had to put her on speakerphone. And eventually she did, and she got put on speakerphone. And then we could hear on the end of the line the ambient sounds of the park. You could hear kids playing. You could hear aeroplanes going overhead and distorting the microphone. You could hear birds singing. And then she began to recite this text that she'd written. Basically, it was a narrative, as I remember it, about a young girl getting drunk with her friends, basically, and going to a beach, if I remember correctly, and hanging out there and having a kind of very formative adolescent experience of being sort of slightly alienated from a social group, but also this like ritualistic kind of imbibing of alcohol. And there was this incredibly focused description of her drinking Bacardi Breezer, which is a kind of rite of passage alcopop that anyone in growing up in the UK is of my generation is likely to have drank far too much of and probably been sick on. And she delivered this text, and it was maybe 7 minutes long. And all the while you could sort of hear her walking around the park. And I think what really stuck out was the sort of effect it had on the audience, that everyone was huddled around the phone, and their earlier awkwardness at having been asked to give our phone numbers over sort of transformed into this extremely receptive attention, like a real collective attention that was paid to this voice on the end of the line. And it sounded very fragile, given that it was coming out of an iPhone speaker and the quality wasn't that good. But it sort of felt like this very, very private, intimate space that, because we were experiencing it collectively, this made me increasingly aware of what the telephone normally represents, and how it's a kind of it can be a very indulgent, sensual kind of space where you're really, really exposed to the intricacies and nuances and warmths and breaths of another person's voice in a way that I think makes you feel extremely close to that person, physically so. And then there's that sort of jarring sense of there being a remove. I mean, the word telephone comes from the Greek, from Greek words for distant and voice. So there's that kind of paradox in the experience of the phone, which I think Anne Harrod Williams in that piece really, really turned into something very, very powerful. It was just an incredibly memorable experience of how an artist might use something that is typically a technology of just enabling you to chat to your friend or to your loved one or order a pizza or whatever it might be, and how that can be a medium through which to create an experience of really great art.
Patrick also talked to me a little about Walter Di Maria's piece, Art by Telephone, which appeared in the famous 1969 exhibition When Attitude Becomes Form.
For that exhibition, which was all a kind of like seminal moment in conceptual art, Walter Di Maria submitted a piece called Art by Telephone. And that was just a telephone on the floor. And I've got it here. It had like a piece of card with the following written on it. It said, "If this telephone rings, you may answer it. Walter Di Maria is on the line and would like to talk to you." So that was the whole work, was that there was a phone in the gallery and the artist was dialing in. And I do think that in some ways the Anne Harrod Williams piece can be thought of as a kind of contemporary version of that. But I think it says something, I think it's better basically, because I was wondering what did people talk about with Walter Di Maria? Like, why was there like some kind of script that he gave, where he gave you some kind of like conceptual koan for you to decipher as an audience member? Or did you just shoot the breeze with Walter Di Maria and that was the work? And then it turns out that he may have never ever called the nine. So maybe that's some unintentional comment about the kind of aloofness of artists, like they don't really want to engage with their public.
After my conversation with Patrick, I got in touch with Anne Harrod Williams and asked her to do a performance for this show. She recorded something she called Look Down at Your Feet. I'd like to play it for you now.
I want you to look down. I want you to look down at your feet. Look down at your feet and tell me, are you looking at male or female feet?
Male.
Get into the feeling of what you've got on your feet. What have you got on your feet?
Shiny black shoes.
Right. Now, I want you to look and feel up the legs and the rest of your body and tell me, what else are you wearing apart from shiny black shoes?
Navy uniform.
Right. Okay. And when you say navy uniform, is it white? Is it an officer's uniform? Does the uniform look like?
A pilot's uniform.
And tell me, how old does your body feel?
Young.
And what's your hair like? Is it short? Do you have a shaved head?
Short back and sides.
Ah, so very proper. So, where are you at the moment?
In a big building.
Right. So do you feel you're about to go flying out somewhere or what?
Yeah.
Right. Who do you fly for? What country?
America.
America, yeah. And if you were to think what year we're in, what year is it?
1956.
Well, what sort of planes do you fly?
For holidays.
Oh, right. So it's a pilot's uniform, not a Navy pilot's uniform.
Yes, it's a Navy color.
Are you alone? Are there many other people there with you?
I see lots of people in a glass building.
Right, okay. So you fly people to various holiday destinations. Do you like your job, Stephen?
I love it.
William sees that work as a kind of channeling, another form of communication like the telephone that we are still able to use freely even during lockdown. Finally, today we'll be ending with another installment of our sound column, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, for which we ask an artist to fill the space of 4 minutes and 33 seconds in whatever way they see fit. It's our nod to John Cage. For this episode, Farah Al-Kassimi played an excerpt from the piano performance from a recent video work called Alone in a Crowd, King of Joy. In the video, she dresses up like a clown and improvises for 10 minutes on a grand piano. For the column, she played this recording through speakers in her apartment, but had to keep it soft enough that it wouldn't bother her co-quarantiners. You can hear a few birds in the background. But before I say goodbye, I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to let you know that you can read the full interview with Josh Smith online and in the summer issue of the Art Review print magazine. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or lurid rants, as always, you can send them to subjectobjectverb@artreview.com. Stay safe out there. Here's Farah. Thank you.
Thank you.